introduce tonight's speakers, Rory Stewart and Dr. Wida Miran. So Rory Stewart has been a diplomat, soldier, explorer, politician, and is currently senior fellow at the Yale Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. In 2003, he became deputy governor in two remote provinces of Iraq, and he recorded in his book, Prince of the Marshes, which is one of four books that he has authored. In 2005, he moved to Kabul to establish an NGO, the Turquoise Mountain Foundation. And from 2010 to 2019, he was an MP holding numerous political roles, including chair of the Defense Select Committee and Secretary of State for International Development. In this seminar, he's joined by Dr. Wida Miran, who is lecturer in politics and international studies at the University of Exeter. She is an expert and has published widely on warlords, conflict, and peace building in Afghanistan. She has served as advisor to national and international organizations, as well as the House of Lords Inquiry on Afghanistan. Her recent research examines propaganda campaigns across a number of violent extremist groups. And she has, for example, published articles on deep analysis of Taliban videos and featured stories in jihadi propaganda. So Rory and Wida will draw on their expertise to discuss the challenges of nation building in Afghanistan and Iraq, and specifically also touch on questions of should the West intervene in such countries and what can Western intervention realistically achieve? So between the two of them, they're going to talk for about 40 minutes and then we'll open it up to Q&A. Abby Turner is going to collect the questions. So if you want to ask your question yourself, we will ask you to unmute. But if you want Abby to turn to put your question to the speakers, that's fine too. And she'll just read it out from the Q&A box. So please be understanding if your question is not selected. If we have a lot of questions, we'll need to make some selection and we might not be able to answer all of them, but we'll certainly give it a try. And then the seminar will end at the latest by 8 p.m., so an hour and 10 minutes from now. All right, with all that said, let me give the floor first to Rory to start us off.
Thank you very much, and it's a great, great pleasure to be here at UCL, and thank you, Incan, for having me. And great privilege also to be with Wida, who knows far, far more about Afghanistan than I will ever know. So really, my role in this is to try to speak slightly from the perspective of this horrible thing known as the international community. In other words, if I have any sort of direct experience, it's not really talking from the perspective, obviously, of somebody in the grassroots of Iraq or Afghanistan, but instead I'm talking from somebody within the bosom of the international system. So very, very briefly as a soldier, then as a diplomat, then as a politician, then as somebody governing a province in Iraq, then someone running a nonprofit in Afghanistan. I've seen the international system from a number of different dimensions. And in fact, I was lucky enough to serve when I was in Indonesia in the lead up to the East Timor referendum. I was in Bosnia and Kosovo. I was in Iraq and Afghanistan. And as an African minister, of course, I got involved in issues such as South Sudan and Somalia, Yemen, Syria, Libya. So this is really an attempt to try to make sense out of that strange working life. And I'm going to begin probably with two central thoughts. The first big thought is that the West, the old West, by which I mean the United States, Canada, Australia, and Europe, and the United Kingdom, is facing a crisis of legitimacy. And a lot of what we need to understand is in terms of this crisis. And it's happened surprisingly recently. And there are two dates that I'd like you to focus on. The first date is 2003, and the second date is 2014. These are slightly strange, unusual dates, and I want to try to justify them for you. 2003, I would argue, was the end of 15 years of extraordinary optimism on the part of the traditional West. It was a period in which the number of democracies in the world exploded from 1988 through to 2003. it was a moment where, following the Cold War, it really felt as though a particular model had won. And that model was very much associated, of course, by the late 90s with third way centrist politics, an idea of a pragmatically regulated free market, summed up with people like Tony Blair and Bill Clinton. But internationally, it was also an idea that there were certain institutions that existed in the West, in particular, democracy and human rights on the one hand, and on the other hand, the idea of free markets, which were almost a universal good that could be exported to the rest of the world. And where do we see this most clearly? We see this, of course, in Francis Fukuyama's book, The End of the History, sort of wonderful expression of this idea that this model has emerged, which is the end of conflict, the end of history, or indeed in the writings of the New York Times op-ed columnist Tom Friedman, right, who very much throughout the 90s celebrates this kind of idea. And there are moments within that period which seem to be great triumphs. And two of those are the interventions in Bosnia and Kosovo. So following on from the terrible humiliation of Rwanda, where a million people were killed and nothing was done, and the humiliation of Srebrenica, where again in the Balkans, there was a real failure to prevent a massacre. From the mid 90s onwards in the Balkans, it seemed as though the West had found a way of ending a war and bringing development and governance to a country. So in Bosnia, for example, which now is in a pretty difficult situation, but at that period, 94, 95, 38,000 people had been killed in Sarajevo by Bosnian Serb artillery. There were checkpoints right across that entire country. There were 130,000 men under arms in paramilitary groups. There were war criminals on the loose. A million refugees had been displaced from their homes. 200,000 properties had been destroyed or confiscated. The intervention happened. The war ceased. And over the next 6 years, that 130,000 people under arms became 6,000 members of the professional army. The checkpoints vanished. The war criminals were put on trial. The properties were restituted and refugees were able to return home. And by 2003, this date that I keep coming back to, the homicide rate in Bosnia was lower than Sweden. And at the same time, this is also the period of the Millennium Summit. You can see this extraordinary picture in the United Nations in September 2000 of 146 world leaders all standing together. And this is where they sign up to the Millennium Development Goals, which commit within 15 years to make these extraordinary advances in terms of human development. And in 2003, too, just to sort of put it in context, this is also a period where the British economy is larger than the Chinese economy still. The French economy is larger than the Chinese economy. The German economy is larger than the French economy. The Japanese economy is substantially larger than the Chinese economy. So that's a little snapshot of 2003. Everybody feeling pretty cheerful, prosperous, and a sense that the West has something to offer, in particular in three things. And usually those three things are characterized as economic development or jobs, security and governance. And these are things that can be exported and particularly exported in Bosnia and Kosovo through military intervention, but not just in Bosnia and Kosovo, in Sierra Leone, for example, as well. And the West is just gearing up to get involved in other places. Gearing up, of course, to get involved in Iraq, gearing up to start putting more resources into Afghanistan, gearing up to get involved in South Sudan, the creation of this new independent state, and gearing up to really try to deal with the conflict in Somalia. Fast forward to 2014. The period 2014 to 2016 is really interesting. Everything has changed in a sort of just over a decade. And a whole new phenomenon emerged, which nobody was really anticipating. So that period 2014-2016, this is when we see Narendra Modi elected. 2016 is when we see Donald Trump elected. This is the period in which Erdogan decisively moves into a more authoritarian role in Turkey. This is the annexation of Crimea. This is Mosul falling to ISIS. This is Russian intervention in Syria, making it clear that there will be no toppling of Bashar al-Assad. This is Mohammed bin Salman emerging to power in Saudi Arabia. This is suddenly the emergence of a very new type of China under Xi Jinping. In Hungary and in Poland, in a Brexit vote, we see the emergence of a new form of populism to parallel these authoritarian tendencies. And in the period leading up to this, all those dreams of 2003 have come crashing down. Iraq and Afghanistan have been revealed as humiliating messes, but so too have South Sudan and Somalia. Confidence has gone out of international peacekeeping. And by the time you look in 2015 at the Sustainable Development Goals, which is the next stage, these Millennium Development Goals in 2000, you suddenly see that there is no longer any real conviction anymore around the ideas of models of democratic government, ideas of security. And instead you have an extraordinary 17-point agenda of obfuscation. And it's now we're in 2021. And we are still living in the dark shadow of that 2014-16 era. It is extremely unlikely that anyone around the world now particularly wants the West to turn up. I am sitting currently on a panel with colleagues from the Global South dealing with conflict resolution and peace building. And pretty much universally, the view is that everything would be better off in Somalia, and people were arguing quite recently in Afghanistan, if the West just got out of the way and let alternative structures step forward. What are those alternative structures? Well, those alternative structures are generally either supposed to be grassroots civil society, bottom-up movements in those countries, or they're supposed to be a new type of global power, countries like China, India, Brazil, Nigeria, or it's supposed to be smaller regional actors. And these ideas are not just appealing to people outside the West, they're appealing to people inside the West. Because increasingly there is a coalition in the West from both the left and the right that doesn't want to have much to do with other people's countries. From the right, it might be, it's none of our business, we don't have any obligation towards these foreigners. From the left, it's, we make as much such a mess of everything anyway, we're so ashamed of ourselves, everything in the world is our fault, probably it's better if we leave them all alone because we mess it all up whenever we turn up. So, and at the same time, the confidence, which in 2003 seemed to be summed up in these sort of centrist governments, has been replaced by a situation in Europe where the left itself doesn't know what it believes. The European left is divided between people who are pro-immigration, and in the case of the Danish left, radically anti-immigration, between people who are in favor of the hijab as a sign of emancipation, people who oppose it as a sign of secularism, divided by people who are in favor of global free trade and people who are increasingly protectionist, and above all, a sense inside Europe and the United States that we are suffering from increasing problems of stagnating wages and inequality, which makes us less and less willing to play a role in the world. Therefore, you can see UK international development spend coming down, European Union development spend coming down. And all these countries now want to believe that maybe these three other groups I talked about, either grassroots civil society or big powers or regional players, will step in. But let's understand what that means. And let's take two case studies of this. Let's take Afghanistan and Somalia. What actually happened when the US removed its troops and NATO removed its troops from Afghanistan was not the sudden emergence of wonderful, diverse, inclusive, grassroots civil society organizations. What actually replaced the Western presence was an armed jihadi group in the form of the Taliban that took power, not elected, but by force, and that has refused to include any women in its cabinet. Again, if we imagine that we're going to talk about major world powers and the arguments about new inclusions on the Security Council, the arguments that people were making in 2003 for India and Brazil look a little bit different when Modi and Bolsonaro are the leaders not in terms of the justice or otherwise of the claims of big countries to participate in the Security Council, but certainly in our confidence that they would be willing to uphold the kinds of international norms which was associated with this period 20 years ago. And as for regional actors, although it's very comforting for the international community to fantasize that the region is going to stabilize Afghanistan, what does that really mean? Right? It means Iran, it means Pakistan, it means Central Asia. Move on to Somalia. Again, the regional actors that are going to come in are going to be Ethiopia and increasingly UAE and Qatar, which have been conducting a proxy war in Somalia, backing different provinces, different warlords, different factions. And again in Somalia, where AMISOM is now up for review and people are very uncertain whether we can continue the funding for the peacekeeping forces on the ground in Somalia, the removal of those forces is not likely, as some of my colleagues believe, to be replaced by a wonderful indigenous grassroots bottom-up approach. It is going to be a replacement very rapidly by Al-Shabaab, another armed jihadist group, which will take control. And this new global order, which is emerging, which of course is a very, very much opposed to intervention. But the age of intervention has finished, and it's very difficult to believe we're going to intervene anywhere in the world again for the next 20 years. But the new global order represents a very dramatic shift in the type of concepts and values which we apply to the rest of the world. And the distance between the old West and other emerging powers is very, very clear on many of these issues. Let me just take one example, perhaps to illustrate it in the field of human rights. Asylum. Essentially, the Global Asylum and Refugee Coalition, for better or worse, is totally dominated by the United States, the European Union, to a lesser extent, Britain and Canada. In the absence of those countries, there is very little asylum settlement around the world. Sweden took in a 10-year period 240,000 asylum applicants. During that same period, Japan took 647 people and China took zero. In fact, over that 10-year period, Sweden alone took more asylum seekers than countries with a combined population of 4 billion people. Luxembourg took more asylum seekers than the whole of Central and South America combined. So this new global order that is emerging is going to be very different from the order that existed before. And this comes back to where I began, which is the question of legitimacy. At the heart of this is a sense that the West no longer has legitimacy. The anger against the United States, Britain, and Europe is paradoxically stronger today than it almost has been at any period since the Second World War. Britain is experiencing, for example, in countries like India, that the narrative against British colonialism is paradoxically stronger today with generations that didn't experience it than it was in the 1950s and 1960s. And that isn't just true externally, it's true internally. As we can see in the United States and Europe, we are going through a very, very deep process of introspection and soul searching that is making us doubt our history, doubt our motivations, doubt our values, and doubt our ability to operate in the world. So a crisis of legitimacy, and on that, over to Wida. Thank you very much indeed.
So on this positive note, we'll turn it over to Wida Mehran. Wida, you have the floor.
Thank you. Sorry, I was on mute here. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here with you tonight. And thanks very much for inviting me here and for the great opening, Rory, for setting this stage for some of the points that I want to discuss with a particular focus on Afghanistan and how the whole process of state building in the country and democratization happened in the country and what went wrong. So a few words about myself and my work. I am from Afghanistan and I've worked on a number of research projects in Afghanistan For more than a decade now, I've researched topics such as human rights, transitional justice, conflict and peace building, with a particular focus on warlordism and the role of warlords in the whole process of democratization in Afghanistan, and more recently, focusing on researching terrorism, including the current Taliban, the current Taliban group that is in power in Afghanistan. So I will start basically in the backdrop of a wonderful discussion that Ruri provided. I'm going to talk about what is happening right now in Afghanistan and setting the stage to talk about what went wrong in the whole process of peace building, state building in Afghanistan. So the current situation in Afghanistan, a lot of us practitioners, scholars, people in Afghanistan, it was unexpected. The manner that the Taliban took over and with the speed that they took over, it was unexpected for a lot of us, given the 20 years of international intervention in the country and billions of dollars spent on the security forces in Afghanistan, on building state institutions, building the civil society in Afghanistan, and all of that crumbling, particularly the state institutions and the security forces, and the Taliban taking over one city after another, and eventually Kabul in a very fast manner, was unexpected to a lot of us. And I will tie that back to what happened in terms of state building that allowed for this situation that happened. I will discuss that in briefly. We'll deal with that point. So what is the current Taliban government in power? They are basically ruling Afghanistan without any legitimacy, international or even national. Internationally, no government has recognized them, even their staunch supporter, the Pakistani government, that has recently been functioning as the spokesperson for the Taliban, trying to raise Taliban's international profile and in conversation with many other governments to get the Taliban to be recognized as a legitimate government of Afghanistan. They haven't even recognized the Taliban as a legitimate government yet. So the Taliban is crumbling under a number of issues that they are facing in Afghanistan. Security situation in Afghanistan is deteriorating. There have been security incidents by terrorist groups in Afghanistan, primarily by Daesh. ISIS-K has been taking mainly responsibilities and for some of the bloodiest attacks on civilians in Afghanistan. Sectarian violence has been attributed to, which has happened recently in Afghanistan, has been attributed by to ISIS. The Taliban is basically presiding on a failing economy and the economic system in Afghanistan is on the verge of collapse. People are, more than 90% of people are living in poverty, and famine is touching those segments of the society that previously had no experience of such famine and poverty. This is to the extent that the grim picture that we get from Afghanistan is that families are selling their children to actually feed the rest of the family members. And who are these children that they are selling? It of almost always is girls that they are selling to feed the rest of the family. And this is becoming more of a heartbreaking practice right now, and more information that the more reports that we get from Afghanistan are pointing to that poverty is pushing families to make such dire decisions. So the Taliban has been adamant and talking about it and saying that they will form an exclusive government in the country, and they were expected to form based on the agreement that they signed with the American, with Biden's administration, the troops withdrawal agreement that they will form an inclusive government. However, Taliban's government so far has been very exclusive. They've only, it's primarily from Pashtun population, Pashtun background, Taliban, only two Tajiks and one Uzbek are in the on the caretaker cabinet, and the basically the criteria that will qualify anybody for the Taliban's to end up with the Taliban leadership and become part of the caretaker cabinet of the Taliban has been two criteria: fighting with the Taliban, being a member of the Taliban, and acquiring some level of education from Islamic madrasas, primarily in Pakistan and on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. So by no means Taliban's government is inclusive, despite the fact that the leadership has been raising this point, and that has been the narrative that they have developed and keep repeating. Obviously, we all know about the situation with women. There are no women present with Taliban's caretaker cabinet, or even the women cannot even go to school or attend universities, and girls cannot go to school. We are all aware of that matter. And the one thing that I wanted to highlight, that what has changed in Afghanistan in the past 20 years, that Afghanistan went through the process of state building and democratization, and democratization that went on in the country. The society, the people in Afghanistan have changed. The Taliban has not changed. The US, when they were negotiating with the Taliban, knew that the Taliban hasn't changed. However, the society and people in Afghanistan have changed. The Taliban, the current society in Afghanistan, younger population, younger generation, they're educated, they're connected to the rest of the world. They are, they have formed associations, they have, they're aware of their rights, they've been connected via social media, via internet, and the message they send out, they are active. Women have been active. Improvements in terms of women's rights have been, in the past 20 years, have been significant in Afghanistan. And the resistance that the Taliban is internally facing is putting a lot of pressure on the current Taliban government in Afghanistan. And what that is, the society, the experience that the Taliban did not have when the first time around they took power in mid-90s. This is a different Afghanistan that the Taliban has to deal with. The expectations from the Taliban are different. And they face that internal pressure by the Afghan population to be transparent in terms of their policies and to show them policies and show action and deliver services, which of course the Taliban has been facing challenges in terms of delivering policies, delivering services in Afghanistan. And the whole discussion and narrative of negotiation with the Taliban in before the Taliban took over, and the whole narrative that the Taliban is, this is Taliban version two, and it has been, it is different. Just a very basic analysis of how the Taliban, different Taliban leadership are talking in about various issues inside Afghanistan would actually show us that that is not true. And it is the pressure that they are facing nationally from inside and also internationally. The international pressure that they've that has been put on the Taliban has pushed them to actually change some of their policies. The Taliban has, as I mentioned, lacks legitimacy and diplomatic recognition by many countries. And that pressure, and from both outside and inside, has push the Taliban to revise some of their policies. The opening of schools, for example, in some cities of Afghanistan, high schools, particularly because the schools were open up to elementary students, girls, but not for middle school and high school. But under the pressure recently, the Taliban has actually revised some of their policies, and in some parts of the country, women can now go, girls can go, now go to schools beyond secondary school. And the Taliban is realizing, reaching the realization that its longevity depends on changing its policies, because if the Taliban does not form that inclusive government, and if it does not allow for women to does not allow for women to go to obtain an education or be employed and work, that the government, their government, will certainly collapse, and they cannot continue as the situation is right now in Afghanistan. So the Taliban has been essentially using Afghan women as a bargaining chip to get political recognition, diplomatic recognition, and the pressure, the international pressure that has been put on the Taliban in terms of withholding funds and international aid, has had a very negative impact also on the general population in Afghanistan, as I described the current economic downturn and lack of access to healthcare services. And also I discussed poverty, widespread poverty in Afghanistan. So what does this whole situation tell us about the liberal peace building project that was implemented in the country starting from 2001 onward with the Bonn Agreement and the various points of Afghanistan going to transitional period to transitioning to a democracy and building state institutions in Afghanistan, so on and so forth. So there are some lessons to be learned from the Afghanistan case that can be very valuable for future international intervention. But before I go into those lessons and count them one by one, I wanted to emphasize one point that also Ruri mentioned, that the whole what happened in Afghanistan and in the manner that the troops were withdrawn and in the and the country falling to the Taliban has actually raised serious questions about the legitimacy of international efforts in state building projects and peace building projects. So in that context, what we can see that the Afghanistan case is becoming very important, an important case that should be discussed and analyzed seriously, particularly that if the international community wants to engage, which is expected in future peace-building projects. So what went wrong in Afghanistan was essentially, it began with the problem that when it comes to the issue of reaching an agreement with potential peace spoilers, potential insurgent groups, a very short-term outlook was taken by international community in Afghanistan. When the Bonn Agreement was signed at the time in 2001, 2003, during that transition period until Afghanistan, the democratization transition period until Afghanistan adopted a democratic constitution and went through the first election in 2004. That was the time that the whole outlook was that the Taliban was defeated, and the Taliban was not seen as a peace, as a peace spoiler, as a potential, not even as a potential peace spoiler. The belief was that the Taliban was out and done with, and they had no power and they could not be part of the whole process. Although at the time the Taliban were willing to negotiate with the US and international community, although earlier on the Taliban were even willing to talk about handing over bin Laden based on some reports. Nonetheless, there's a top-down approach that the international community took, and being overconfident in the fact that, overconfident in the belief that there's liberal peace building project will unfold in Afghanistan and will be successful. And once the money is poured in and the troops are in Afghanistan, the boots are on the ground, it will be a successful project. There is no need to talk to rogue actors such as the Taliban and incorporate them, who are then seen, viewed as terrorists or harboring terrorists. So this overconfidence in the success of liberal peace building project and policies from the very early on and from the beginning of state building in Afghanistan was proved to be very problematic, as we all see. The other issue, excuse me, the other issue was the other problem was the a complete and total disregard in addressing the political economy of conflict in Afghanistan. The belief was that market economy and provision of opportunities for illicit economic opportunities will actually miraculously take the country away and take the society away and warlords, for example, away and militias away from illicit economic means. Corruption overtook, corruption was widespread in Afghanistan at the time, from earlier on until pretty much very recently before the country fell to the Taliban. Corruption by a lot of actors, particularly strongmen, militiamen, and warlords was overlooked in favor of security, because the view was that rather do not touch these actors lest they become another security challenge and join the Taliban. And all of this, letting the actors such as warlords to get rich and engage in illicit economic means and expand their power base, all of that essentially led to undermining the central government in Afghanistan. And it led to hollowing out the state and leaving the central government essentially within the precinct of Kabul and not much power and presence in many cities and areas in the country that were either controlled by these warlords and other actors, and most of them also during the past 20 years were controlled also by the Taliban. And the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan, as I mentioned, also gave this state building, liberal peace building, liberal state building project in Afghanistan it leads to questioning its legitimacy in general at the international level. However, I don't want to basically conclude on that negative image, but there are certain achievements throughout this whole 20 years of intervention in Afghanistan that, despite the fact that the Taliban is in power, despite the fact that it has become extremely difficult for the Afghan civil society to actually raise their voice, and it is more and more difficult for them to protest and resist Taliban's ruling when it comes to various economic political issues in the country. And nonetheless, over the past 20 years, a generation of Afghan grew up in the country that has been well connected to the rest of the world. And they've led a lifestyle that was significantly different from what the previous generations in Afghanistan experienced. The free and dynamic media in Afghanistan, Was one of the achievements in the country that despite Taliban's rule right now, they're struggling to hold it, despite the fact that the Taliban are putting more and more restrictions on the media in Afghanistan. We still get, there is still media sources in Afghanistan that are analyzing Taliban's policies, they are questioning Taliban leadership, and they provide coverage of protests against the Taliban. Sometimes these journalists are actually showing up at the protests knowing that the Taliban might beat them up, break their telephones and cameras and equipments, and they might even put them in jail. So we, in these 20 years, have actually led to building such a civil society in Afghanistan that despite all the odds is still operating and is still resisting Taliban's rule in Afghanistan. And women, as I mentioned, women's in terms of achievements in terms of women's rights and educated women in Afghanistan right now being at the forefront of resistance against the Taliban. And many times the discussion has been that Afghan women had, and you would hear this, actually I've heard it quite often, both inside and outside Afghanistan, that their role was symbolic. That is an absolutely wrong narrative to promote. Afghan women were made huge and significant contributions economically, politically, socially in Afghanistan. When they were in politics, they made they have been at the forefront of many political changes and policy changes, and when it comes particularly to ensuring women's rights in Afghanistan. And when that, despite the fact that a critical mass of people left Afghanistan, particularly from, and are still leaving the country, we still see that the dynamic society is still struggling and trying to resist and trying to maintain those values and fight for those values, such as freedom of speech, such as women's rights in the country. That is a big achievement for Afghan people that are still trying to hold on to that. And in the face of a jihadi group that has known nothing but fight and engage in violence. And that is a fact that we all need to remember about people in Afghanistan right now, particularly civil society and women in Afghanistan who are fighting for their rights. I will stop at that.
Thank you so much, Wida and Roy, for your fascinating insights and sharing all of your experience with us tonight. I certainly have learned a lot, and I'm sure our audience has as well. So there's a number of questions already in the chat. Great, keep them coming. I'd say we start off, start with two or three of them, which go in a similar direction here, where Wida also left us off, which is sort of what went wrong and how could have been potentially better in the past, or how could it be done different and potentially better in the future. So there's a few questions here that go in the same direction, and I would call on these people to unmute themselves and then start their questions. So there's one by Amin Riyad, a second by Natasha Victor on alternative dispute resolution, and then one more by Constance Gillies. So maybe start with Amin.
Hello, can you hear me?
All good.
I'm just trying to ask a question to Mr. Rory Stewart about his experience in Iraq. And my question is, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, does he think that there is, you know, things that he could have done differently to achieve a much more effective, sustainable results in Iraq in his experience in as a governor there? Thank you.
Thank you, Amin. And we'll take the other ones. Natasha Victor, if you could unmute yourself.
Hello, good evening. My question is, how do we implement alternative dispute resolution mechanisms in the diplomatic and peace building processes when trying to mediate between parties that have and nation states with different cultural, ethical values, ideologies, and social norms? Thank you.
Okay, great. Big question there. And then third one, Constance Gillies. Constance, are you with us? Do you want to unmute yourself and ask your question? So let me read Constance's question. So Constance is asking, do you think that the outcome would have been different if the nature of US withdrawal had been different? So if it had not been so sudden and without notice, has that played a role in shaping the outcome? And if so, how? So let's start with those three in terms of how it may have been different or what to learn from the future.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, these are very, very difficult questions. Let me just acknowledge sort of two of them in passing. This question around different norms and values is vital. And often when we talk about conflict mediation or peace building, there is a general assumption that everybody shares our values. And of course, the reality is that the Taliban or Al-Shabaab do not share our values. And to some extent, when you're negotiating with the Chinese government, they may not buy into bits of the Western human rights agenda. In fact, authoritarian states in general may question a lot of the fundamental assumptions. So just register that. And I think you're right that that's a big problem. On the bigger issue of what could have been done differently, either in Iraq or Afghanistan. So firstly, in relation to Riyadh in Iraq, the whole model structurally is wrong. So it's not a question in these places of, I wish I'd done X, Y, or Z. The fundamental problem is that foreign powers in these contexts structurally, inherently lack knowledge, power, and legitimacy, and cannot understand the limits of their power. And so the problem in Iraq, essentially, was that it was a heavy footprint. It was the formation of the occupation government, the attempt to do too much. And I would argue the same is true in Afghanistan. This is more controversial, but in Afghanistan, actually, I think the problem was the surge. We got tempted into doing things we couldn't do. And this is a very, very difficult truth because you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, right? So Wida pointed out the incredible problems that emerged in Afghanistan in the 4 years after the intervention, 2001 to 2005. Things looked good in Kabul. The economy had doubled in size. Things looked pretty good in Hazarajat, the Bamiyan Valley, and in the cities. But if you were a woman in the Sangin district in Helmand, you were having a pretty horrible time because the province was controlled by a governor, a police chief, and an army commander who were essentially jihadi commanders, armed militia commanders associated with three different tribal groups. And your experience was that your relatives were being killed, you were being robbed, you might even be being sexually assaulted. There was no functioning economy and very little delivery of services. And Helmand was pumping out 60% of the drugs in Afghanistan. So the question is, what do you do? Right. What do you do as an international intervention when in 2004-05 you confront a situation where corrupt warlords are dominating a province and the place is pumping out drugs and people are having their human rights abused? I believe that what you have to do is acknowledge that there is not much you can do about that, and that actually trying to do things about that is going to make the situation worse. And that is a very, very, very difficult truth to take on board if it's true. That is not what the international community did. The international community decided that it was going to try to sort those things out. So 2005, those people were fired from their jobs. Now, remember, these are people who'd been appointed by the elected president. Karzai had been elected in 2004. He'd appointed these people. But the international community forced them to get rid of them. Then they deployed troops in. And initially, they deployed troops in 2006 into Helmand, not to fight the Taliban, because the Taliban didn't really exist in 2006. Very, very small. They deployed it in order to do reconstruction. They thought they were going to come in. They brought in a guy called Engineer Daoud, who was meant to be a clean technocratic governor from Kabul. And they tried to believe that if they got going with economic development, brought in more technocratic governance, and provided a security umbrella around it, they would be able to address the root causes of conflict. In fact, what happened is that they sparked a Taliban insurgency. They gave the Taliban the ability to say they were fighting for Afghanistan and Islam against a foreign military occupation. And by firing these people, they created a power vacuum and they drove these warlords and militias into the opposition. So from then onwards, these people, Sheikh Mohammed Akhundzadeh and others, found themselves allied effectively with the Taliban, continuing to create drugs, continuing to put their own militiamen on the side of the Taliban. How did the international community decide to respond to this? Not by saying, oh, we've made a terrible error, we should stop doing this. No, they double down. So they then follow up with the British troops, US Marines then go in. By 2006, 2007, it's looking worse and worse and worse, right? By 2009, they eventually decide the problem is that they need to essentially surge in and control the whole country. The only way they're going to do this is by a massive counterinsurgency warfare campaign, where they're going to rebuild governance, rebuild security, rebuild economic development from the ground up. And they do it eventually with 130,000 troops. Now, $100 trillion a year of expenditure. And this continues until 2014. Now, by that period, they estimate in 2005, there are 3,000 Taliban fighters. They proceed to kill 30, 40,000 people. And then they announce there are 70,000 Taliban fighters, right, by the end of this period. At which point they then revert back to where I believe they should have been in the first place, which is a light footprint. Right? I actually think that the position in 2003, 4, 5, difficult though it was better than what followed it. And that what we should have done is sustained a light footprint in Afghanistan. That it would have been very easy to keep 2,500 American troops in Afghanistan. There would be no casualties for 18 months. And by keeping them, it was relatively easy to prevent the Taliban maintaining control of an urban center. They could seize these centers, they would then lose them. Instead of which, we're in a very black and white world. You know, either we do it perfectly or we don't want to do it at all. Okay, now Wida will disagree with this though. Remember, all this stuff is disagreed with.
I actually agree with most of what you said in response to what could have been done differently and if, in terms of troops withdrawal, and if it hasn't happened so fast, would have the outcome be different? I believe, yes, it would have been different if a political agreement was reached with the Taliban, between the Afghan government and the Taliban, and that transitional authority was formed and the Taliban were incorporated and into the power structure in Afghanistan, instead of like basically taking over by force, that would have been definitely, obviously, a different outcome for Afghanistan. Now, the agreement between the US and the Taliban was essentially that the Taliban shall not enter Kabul. And that's why the Taliban leadership has been saying as well that they did not want to enter Kabul, but the Afghan president Ghani left Kabul, and then the Taliban entered the city, and their justification was basically that we had to enter the city because there was a power vacuum and we had to take over, otherwise criminal groups might have been preying on the civilian population, and we needed to provide security, so on and so forth. But the mere fact that during the whole process of negotiating with the Taliban, the US government, two different administrations, Trump and Biden, they both bypassed Afghan government and directly negotiated bilateral negotiations with the Taliban. It was a huge blow to the Afghan government's legitimacy, and it weakened it. That eventually also led to Taliban taking over. The negotiation was a very top-down process between two parties only, and the elected government in Afghanistan was bypassed. The whole process was faulty from the beginning on, when the whole negotiations started and when the troops withdrawal agreement was signed in February of 2019. Those things could have been done differently. The international troops were not expected, nobody in Afghanistan and obviously outside Afghanistan expected that the troops will remain in Afghanistan for a very long period of time, indeterminately. We expected troops to leave eventually, but not in this manner, not in a manner that every concession was made to the Taliban. The Afghan government was sidelined, despite the fact, I agree, that it had its own problems. It was suffering from corruption, widespread corruption, so on and so forth. But nonetheless, it did not have to happen in this manner. And the mere fact that hands off, we are out. Once we are out, we are out. If we are in, no matter if the policies, like as Ruri was describing, even if they were not effective, they kept continuing implementing the same policies. And the same approach was taken when troops withdraw, without any regard to what Afghan population wants and without much discussion with the Afghan government, with the elected government in Afghanistan. Adding to some of the points that Ruri mentioned in terms of like this top-down policy implementing, knowing it's wrong, I used to call it lessons unlearned. Similar policies that were implemented in Iraq and they failed. The same model was taken and implemented in Afghanistan. Obviously, it failed again. It's try, fail, try again, and fail again, and continue failing. So this lack of proper negotiation and accounting for what the many local aspects and local factors and incorporating what the actually people wanted on the ground and how the government worked on the ground and taking a much lighter foot approach, it would have been a much better approach in terms of the whole state building project in Afghanistan. And as I mentioned, now I made a detour in going back to your point, one of the questions about the withdrawal and the manner that troops withdrawal was done. It still came from a similar position that it was the decision by the US. It was implemented without any regard to the Afghan government or the Afghan population in general.
Excellent. Thank you both for answering those questions. So there's a few more, and I'd say let's pick another three. Bundle them up. There's a few that fall in the same conceptual category of where Afghanistan has been in the past with a broader historical view and where it might go in the future, near and medium term. So I'd like to call on Wenheng Liu, on Zhezhu Ong, and then on Benedetta Jokoli. So let's start with Wenheng. Can you unmute yourself?
Sorry, could you please read my question? I'm in the library.
Sure. Very good, Wenheng, to be in the library at this hour. So Wenheng's question is sort of a broad historical view. So one, has the US 2 decades of operations in Afghanistan benefited more than it has cost? And then second, the bigger historical question, looking back at the history of the United Kingdom in the 19th century, Soviet Union in the 20th century, in the United States in the 21st century in Afghanistan, why does Afghanistan always make superpowers frustrated? And is this a historical law or coincidence? That was Wenheng's question. Next, I'd like to go to Zhezhu.
Hi, I'd like to ask if there is any like groups currently in Afghanistan that our panelists feel has the legitimacy to rule in place of the current Taliban administration.
Thank you, Zhezhu. And then Benedetta, are you with us?
Yes. So my question is for both speakers, I'd say. What do you see Afghanistan going in the short to medium term, I'd say, in terms of government, political structure, and so on?
Okay, I'll start away. The question of legitimacy in Afghanistan is a very, very difficult one to answer because, of course, the Taliban government was not elected. There's a tendency of people in the United States and Europe to imagine that somehow the Afghan people chose the Taliban. I mean, I'm currently arguing passionately against sanctions. I believe we should be very generous with our development and humanitarian assistance to Afghanistan at the moment. And occasionally people push back and say, you know, people chose the Taliban. Of course, they didn't choose the Taliban. The Taliban were not elected at all, right? They didn't come into these towns with everybody waving flags saying, hooray, you know, welcome Taliban. On the other hand, it's very difficult to see what alternative groups can emerge. And if there's a common theme, I'm not going to go back to the 19th century, but if there's a common theme in recent Afghan politics, it is the fragility of these political structures. So we went through a bewildering sequence of people from the time that the king went in the early 1970s. Daoud Khan was followed by Nur Muhammad Taraki, followed by a man called Hafizur Amin, followed by a man called Babrak Kamal, followed by Najibullah, followed by a civil war in which various people came up and down. But when you look at the Taliban itself, and this is something Weeder, I think, can be very interesting on, is it took power surprisingly quickly out of nowhere in the mid-1990s. I mean, nobody, you know, knew about this group or had heard of it in 92. If you'd said in 92, you know, that these great famous warlords like Hikmati or Massoud were going to be suddenly swept aside by a completely unknown group associated with a few madrasas on the Pakistan border, people would have thought you're crazy, right? So they took power very, very quickly. They flipped 20,000 villages in their favor. And then in 2001, they lost power just as quickly. Right? In about 3 weeks, they disappeared. Boom, like this, nothing. And it wasn't a big military intervention, right? About 1,500 American troops and a few Afghan militias, and suddenly, boom, the Taliban vanished. And now they've come back again at the same extraordinary speed. They went from zero district capitals to controlling the whole country in the space of a few weeks. So there's something very, very odd about the way that Afghan politics works. And it's quite likely the Taliban can be kicked out again in exactly the same way. I mean, they're a very fragile, thin group. There's not many of them. But something about Afghan society seems to mean that 20,000 villages can flip one way, flip back another, flip back another, flip back another. Okay, on that, over to Weeda.
Yes, it is a very, I absolutely agree. It is a very fragile situation and anything could happen. And the Taliban, one thing for sure, the Taliban cannot maintain the same status right as it has right now, because there are many pressures put on the Taliban and the Taliban knows that it cannot continue as it is. So there should be some sort of a political settlement reached that the Taliban opens up and becomes more inclusive and incorporates other political groups. Otherwise, which I'm hoping the other scenario in short term or medium term, which I hope it won't happen. There might be some sort of civil war or conflict, which that's the worst case scenario that might happen in Afghanistan. And given that the Taliban given that other terrorist organizations in Afghanistan are operating, and that can actually add another level of complexity to the fragile security and situation in Afghanistan. So we are all hoping that the Taliban political leadership manages the internal fragmentations of the Taliban group and honors some of its political promises that it has made in terms of inclusivity, forming an inclusive government, and incorporates others. Because otherwise the current situation is very dire, fragile, and unstable, and the Taliban cannot maintain the country and continue as it is right now.
Thank you both. I'd say I think we have time for one more round of questions from people. So there's a number of questions that all go to the idea of who are the actors in these external interventions. So there's a question by Eleftheria Kusta by M. Johnson and Chris Green. So if we could start with Eleftheria, if you want to unmute yourself.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
First of all, thank you both for your presentation. It was really interesting. I just wanted to ask, because authoritarian mentions becoming more prominent in the international system was raised by Rory. I was wondering, given their increased involvement of authoritarian actors in foreign conflicts and proxy warfare, what would you think their impact would be for protecting civilians caught in the crossfire? And would you say that evidence suggests that their impact would be different from democratic intervention? And in this case, do you think in terms of advocacy, we should pursue more engagement with them or adopt a more heavy-handed and critical stance? Thank you.
Thank you, Eleftheria. M. Johnson? M. Johnson, are you with us, or do you want me to read your question? So let me read it out loud for the benefit of the audience. So he or she asks, is there an additional factor at play in the rejection of Western political institutions and values, and that these have grown in the context of imperialism and economic colonialism, and this type of international relationship and the wealth that came from it is just not available in other countries? In other words, if Western institutions had not grown up under economic advantage, what might they have been? What might they have been, and would they have been more attractive to other countries? And then lastly, we have a question from Chris Green. All right, I'm gonna read Chris's question as well, which is much more UK focused. So the defense budget was recently cut, and Boris Johnson seemed to suggest in the PMQs that the future of our forces would be different. Do you think that the UK has retired, quote unquote, from nation building? And is the cost or rise of new powers the biggest factor in this decision? I think you're still
here. Here we go. Yeah. Certainly the UK is in full out retreat, and not just the UK, the US. My personal view is that the tilt to China, to the Asia Pacific, which is the phrase in Britain, is basically an alibi for abandoning its involvement in much of the world, Africa, Middle East, et cetera. There seems to be very, very little interest anymore within the United Kingdom in playing this kind of role. And in fact, probably the only member of the Old West that still seems to have any residual interest in this kind of operation is France. Right. Otherwise, people have largely given up. And I have very little confidence that the European Union is going to really fill that gap. Because if I look at European Union policy towards Yemen, towards Bolivia, towards Ukraine, it's very difficult to believe that there is a serious, focused, and coherent policy operation. Which brings us to authoritarian actors. Authoritarian actors in these countries, the fundamental problem in terms of their relationship to win civilian populations and the different from democratic actors is that their entire operations are covert, right, and deniable. There is no transparency, there's no accountability. If the Wagner Group, which is a Russian mercenary group, is operating in the Central African Republic or Mali, if UAE or Qatar are getting involved in Libya or getting involved in Somalia, if the Pakistan ISI are operating inside Afghanistan, none of this is acknowledged. Right? Many, many errors are made by these democratic forces, and there are attempts to cover up. Nevertheless, the fact is that it is clear what the US was doing, by and large. There are some details around the CIA and special forces operations, but predominantly this stuff is open to scrutiny. The New York Times can write reports about where a drone attack has gone. There are congressional committees. People can examine, right? And the solution to this problem, unfortunately, is the restoration of a global order. It's the vacuum that has been left behind by the United States that encourages this action from authoritarian actors. The whole reason why Qatar and UAE are jockeying in this fashion is largely to do with the US retreat from the region. People wouldn't feel necessary to try to position themselves in these bizarre ways in Yemen, in Afghanistan, in Somalia, in the same way if there was a confident sense that the United States and its allies, represented through the Security Council, had an idea of what they were doing. But that, of course, brings us to the third problem, which was raised around this critique of imperialism, which is what I began with, which is this is not a very welcome message. Essentially, we now see the West as deeply morally compromised. Increasing numbers of people inside our countries and outside the countries feel that we have an enormous amount to be ashamed of in our past, and that we lack the moral authority and legitimacy to talk to anybody about these issues, which is why one of the things that nobody mentioned when we left Afghanistan, which is a real sign of the age we're in, is the fact that it was a democracy. Right? In 2003, people would have been very focused on the number of democracies in the world and a democracy being lost. But nobody actually really seemed to pay much attention in Myanmar, but they definitely aren't pointing out that for all its flaws, and Afghanistan, of course, had corruption, had inequality, had abuse, had violence, it had an elected government. And that seems to mean nothing to us now. And that's a very, very interesting suggestion in the way in which our values have changed.
Wida, would you like to weigh in on the last set of questions before we close?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, very quickly, just on the notion of imperialism and particular values that were basically brought in, based on one narrative, brought into Afghanistan through the whole state building project and building democracy in Afghanistan. That's not entirely accurate. That when it comes to value of education, freedom of speech, and elections and stuff. So this is the Afghanistan did have a history in terms of promoting women's rights, in terms of human rights, in terms of also elections. And so this is not an entirely Western project, and that was totally in. If we take one extreme view and brought exported to Afghanistan and implemented there. So Afghanistan over a very, and putting it into more of a historical perspective over a very short period in 50 years or something, Afghanistan went from a monarchy to adopting experiencing a communist regime to an autocratic regime and civil wars and so on and so forth, and in democracy in 2001 onwards. So Afghanistan, it seems, if we look at the historical past of Afghanistan, it has been like experimenting different types of regimes for various reasons, and then certain elements of one form of or another type of regime, despite its short longevity, for example, when it comes to communist regime or the very short period of constitutional democracy that Afghanistan had following the fall of the monarch, is that certain elements of that remained in Afghanistan. And in some regards, they were built on. And certain values remained from that historical past of Afghanistan, from historical experiences of the country, that it wasn't all of a sudden that Afghan people got exposed to women's education, that women in Afghanistan all of a sudden learned about their rights. That is not an accurate narrative either, that everything was imported to Afghanistan from abroad, that these were... Afghanistan changed like many other countries, and through the passage of time, it also, and very diverse experiences that the country has had. There are certain values that were in Afghanistan in its history and culture that remained there, and many were built upon that we might wrongly attribute everything to outside forces.
Okay, thank you both for your insights. Thank you everybody for submitting your questions. I think we are just about out of time, hitting 8 p.m. sharp. Thank you for submitting all the questions and making this a really engaging exchange tonight, and especially a big thank you to our two fabulous speakers tonight, Wida Miran and Rory Stewart, who have shared their insights with us and have taken an hour of their time to be with us tonight. Thank you so much for sharing your contributions. If you would like to follow along for tonight's event and the recording will be on our website, and Abby will follow up with communication about the podcast and the recording tomorrow. Also, just to mention that, of course, this is part of a bigger speaker series for politics and practice. And next week, we'll have an event on politics and the press, then and now. So please look out for the follow-up communication regarding this event next week as well. So with that, a big round of applause to our two speakers. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Wow.